I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. There's a musical education program that's having astounding success. Not only do all the kids who pick up an instrument move on to the next grade, they do better in class, too. We'll find out how Harmony Project KC improves the lives of underserved kids, one measure at a time. Then, Bryan Cranston brought more than 100 characters to life, and that was before playing Breaking Bad's Walter White. We'll bring you Steve Kraske's conversation with the award-winning actor who says luck played an important role in his success. Finally, the latest edition of Local Listen will get you up to date after this hour's news. Margaret Martin became a parent while still a teenager. She survived domestic violence and at one point was a homeless mother of two. In 2011, Dr. Margaret Martin received this nation's second highest civilian honor, the Presidential Citizens Medal, for her founding of Harmony Project. Started in L.A. back in 2001, this project provides instruments and music lessons to the most vulnerable children in the city. And the results were positive enough that other cities around the country started affiliates, including what you're hearing right now, Harmony Project KC, which started last year. Dr. Martin's in town for an event at the Kansas City Public Library this evening, and she joins us now here in the studio. Hello, Margaret.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. So before we talk about the project, I want to talk a little about you, since your story is a big part of why this project came to be. When you were these kids' age that we're hearing right now playing in an orchestra, what was going on in your life?
Probably what was going on in most kids' lives. I always loved music, but I didn't have. I grew up in a family that wasn't able to provide the opportunities that we are able to provide the students in Harmony Project. What we call what we do essentially mentoring through music, and everybody could use a mentor. I mean, you could use a mentor. I can use mentors.
Sure.
We all can use them, but kids growing up in low income families are not likely to sign up for a multi-year mentoring program. The cool thing is it takes your whole life to learn to make music well. So if you engage kids with professional musician mentors and fun groups, over time, the process is so joyful.
Yeah.
They learn to make increasingly challenging music together.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Hawaiian Islands.
Okay.
And then as a young child, and then I went to high school in Santa Barbara, California.
And how come you didn't have access to that kind of musical mentor?
Well, you know, my folks split up. They never had much money. I actually supported myself from the age of 15.
Wow. And that left you then in a position to not have time for things like music, I would imagine.
Of course.
So how did that all change? Where did you end up after that?
As you mentioned, I had a sort of a challenging early life, and I enrolled as a freshman at Los Angeles City College at the age of 33. 10 years later, I'd earned a bachelor's, a master's, and a doctorate in public health. During the course of that time, became inspired to launch Harmony Project.
What do you feel like was the turning point for you?
In regard to
your own life, I mean, from being having to support yourself at 15, and you mentioned you were a teenage mother, but by 33 you were enrolling in college.
I was enrolling in college, and it's a lot. You know, I hadn't had a math class in 17 years, and it was scary. But I was also hungry. I know the difference. I know the difference that education can make. I know how transformative it is, and I can actually recall being ignorant about pretty basic things, and I was so hungry for the opportunity to get that education.
Yeah. How were you able to finally do that? What made the difference?
Well, it was a combination of I I bought an old house that had a rental income with it, and renovated the parts that we rented out, and slowly renovated the parts that we were living in. So yeah. It sort of lowered the monthly nut and enabled me to dig in and go back to school. And the process sort of set a good example for my kids. Their mom was, you know, I spent 10 years in school, but 10 years later I'd completed a bachelor's, a master's, and a doctorate at UCLA in public health.
So in 2001, when you founded the Harmony Project, was there a certain incident or moment that where you said, here's the vision, this is what we're going to try to do?
Yeah, there was. Actually, it came a little before that. I was still in grad school. On a Sunday, I was at a farmer's market in Hollywood, California, and through the market came a posse of gnarly-looking L.A. gang members, shaved heads, tattoos, oversized clothing. They stopped in front of a small child playing Brahms on a tiny violin. After 5 or 6 minutes, without saying a word to one another, I watched those gang members pull out their own money and lay it gently in the child's case.
And how did that inspire you to do this?
They were essentially teaching me that they would rather be doing what this kid is doing than what they were doing, but they never had the chance. And I was at UCLA at the time, completing a doctorate in public health focused on what it takes to make a healthy community. And I knew that I had to try. So the thing is, that child in the farmer's market was my 5.5-year-old youngest son.
Wow.
And so the moment was really salient to me. Here's gang members in his face. I was ready to, you know, save the day if anybody messes with him. And instead, when they did this sort of authentic moment of grace happens in front of me, I just melted down. And the thing is, I was looking at this through multiple lenses. One, as an academic, as a doctoral candidate in public health at UCLA. Two, as the mother of this child, I knew everything that went into this, but also as someone who'd lived in poverty with children. And we were spending more money on my youngest son's music lessons than I had lived on in a year with his two older siblings.
Wow.
So that put it into perspective. I knew that those kids and anyone associated with them would never have the opportunity to learn to make music well that my youngest son had. And at the same time, I knew that that was just wrong, and I wanted to do something about it. So when I completed the degree, I launched Harmony Project in 2001 with one $9,000 check from Rotary Club of Hollywood, a shout out for Rotary, and 36 kids from low-income homes. If it hadn't worked, I would clearly be doing something else. But 8 years later, I was at the White House receiving the highest honor in the nation for an arts-based youth program from Michelle Obama. And 2 years later, I was invited back to receive the Presidential Citizens Medal from her husband.
What can you give us a sense of the gist of the program? What does a kid have to do to be part of it? What do you do with them?
Well, we engage kids with professional musicians whom we train as mentors, 5 to 12 hours a week, year-round, tuition-free, for their entire childhood, from as early as we can get them, preschool, first grade, second grade, all the way up through high school graduation. And we teach the kid to play increasingly challenging music, and we build ensembles with them. Kids, and as kids advance, we train them to help mentor their less advanced peers. So we develop this positive network of social support that sticks with kids for their entire childhood, provides them responsibility and respect, and enables them to develop confidence and the ability to capacity to express themselves with dignity, power, and grace.
Mm-hmm. Well, the program here in Kansas City is fairly new, but we'll talk about that in a moment. But we want to talk with someone who's gone all the way through it. And joining us now is Andrew Lovegood, who's in his second year at Los Angeles City College. He participated in Harmony Project throughout his teen years. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning.
And Andrew's joining us by Skype. Since you're a college student and it's 2 hours earlier there, all I can say is sorry to wake you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how'd you become involved in Harmony Project?
Well, actually, my brother was the first of my family to really join. He had this music department in his school through Harmony Project. And I had started also through a middle school orchestra, just learning how to play cello. And one week he told me, you know, you should come and we should talk to, you know, whoever's in charge and see if we can, you know, have you play in the orchestra. And so I ended up going for a week, and and the rest is, you know, history. I ended up staying and playing with all their ensembles and all throughout high school, and now I'm in college, and I continue to go back and mentor and play with them. Now, so it's a really fun. Yeah, sorry.
No, that's all right. That's great. Did your school have music classes?
I actually went. My middle school had a music, you know, quote unquote room. So it was kind of like a one class per day. You know, through Harmony Project, I ended up actually going to an arts high school in downtown Los Angeles. So my entire high school life was all really about music, all day, every day.
Yeah. Andrew, can you tell me a little about the neighborhood where you grew up and your family?
I grew up in Koreatown, which is kind of like right around downtown Los Angeles. It wasn't the best neighborhood, but it wasn't too dangerous either. My whole family lived in this like one bedroom apartment. We had five or six people at one point in time. And it was always so crowded, always so, so loud. And, that's pretty much, the family aspect of it.
Was it a situation where there would have been any other conceivable way for you to have music lessons and get this kind of training?
No, actually, I truly believe that if I had not joined Harmony Project, I would probably not be in music. It was through Harmony Project that I had all these great opportunities and all these lessons. And if I had not joined, I would not probably be pursuing a career in music. I'd probably be one of those people who, you know, says, oh, yes, back in my youth, I played cello for a couple of years, but I was never really that good, you know?
A couple of months in my case.
Yeah.
Did you like it right away? I mean, did it instantly say, I am going to be a musician, or did it take you a little longer to warm up to it?
Well, at first, as most parents would, they were very afraid because, you know, a career in music isn't a steady career, and it's a very struggling life, but so I was a little discouraged at first, but within a couple of years through Harmony Project, I was really geared towards, you know, being happy and doing what I love for the rest of my life. So I think Harmony Project really had an effect on what I wanted to do for the rest of my life and how I wanted to spend my life.
We should mention that Margaret is here in town for an event tonight at the Kansas City Public Library. She's talking about the power of music this evening at the Plaza Branch. There's a reception at 6, and the presentation begins at 6:30. You can reserve a seat for that at kclibrary.org. We're talking with Margaret Martin about the founding of Harmony Project. Margaret, how did this program end up expanding to other cities, including Kansas City?
Well, what happened was we noticed that kids from the low-income communities in L.A., where dropout rates were about 50%, and where prior research shows that those that graduate tend to graduate several grade levels below their more advantaged peers. Our students, since 2008, between 90 and 100% of them every year, of our high school seniors who've been with us at least 3 years, have gone to college. And colleges, you know, like Dartmouth, Tulane, NYU, USC, Harvard, Princeton, Smith, UC Berkeley, it was crazy. And what's more, 30 to 50% every year are entering high-value science, technology, engineering, and math majors.
So they're not becoming necessarily music majors at these places.
Most of them don't end up majoring in music. A lot of them will minor in music or double major in music. But most of them are going after other kinds of careers and really challenging ones, and it made no sense. I'm a social scientist, and social science could not explain what we were seeing. So
how do you explain it?
Well, I bothered a lot of people, and eventually the head of child health and human development at the NIH referred me to Nina Krause at the Auditory Neuroscience Lab at Northwestern University. And from Dr. Krauss, we learned that poverty and adverse life events can negatively impact a child's developing brain and capacity to learn in biologically measurable ways. We were fortunate, privileged to participate in randomized, controlled, longitudinal prospective research with that lab in which they sent a neuroscience team with their equipment out to L.A. Every year to assess kids. They've now published 10 peer-reviewed journal articles documenting significant improvement in cognitive function. Essentially, what we've learned and been able to prove is that what we're doing, intensive music making, enables kids growing up in low-income homes to essentially rewire their brains in ways that improve their capacity to learn. And once that happens...
Not just about music.
Once that happens, they just take off, and everything that the teachers are doing starts to work.
So Margaret, I know you work with a lot of cities. You travel all over the place talking about this. I know your partnership here is with the Northeast Community Center. How does a partnership like that typically come to be? How much originates locally, and how much direction comes from your national headquarters in L.A.?
Well, that's really interesting. I think in response to your earlier question, they got in touch with us after seeing a PBS NewsHour piece about the neuroscience research findings and came out to L.A. All of our affiliates are independently financed and locally operated, but we have annual convenings. We have conference calls several times a month about various topics. And we provide actually the Yamaha organization, the Yamaha Music and Wellness Institute, is in the process of developing, building a data management system that will enable us to track our kids in the same way across all of our affiliates.
I want to ask you, Andrew Loveland, as a successful graduate of this program, and you hear about these longitudinal studies and the scientific research that says it works. How has it worked for you? How has your life benefited from being part of this?
Well, you know, Harmony Project has taught me it's a lot more than just music lessons. It's a very much like a whole life lesson, music lesson gift that they give. You know, it's aside from teaching music, you know, they teach you how to manage your time. You know, how are you supposed to practice when you have, you know, 5 hours of homework to do every night? How are you supposed to keep up with all your stuff? So, I mean, really, you know, they teach you time management. How are we supposed to, you know, different career paths and, you know, teaching us that if we do well in school and, you know, we follow what we want to do, we can really pursue any kind of career. So that's a really important point that they make.
And Andrew, what are you studying now at Los Angeles City College? What are your future goals?
Right now I'm a music major, but when I do transfer to a four-year institution, I am thinking about double majoring in music and neuroscience.
Wow. So all of the threads coming together then.
Yeah, very much.
Margaret, what's next for Harmony Project? Is this more expansion to different cities, or are you taking the program in some other way?
No, we're focused on enabling communities to replicate the model in Title I schools. We're partnering with...
What does that mean, Title I schools?
Title I schools, I'm sorry, Title I is a federal initiative that works on closing the achievement gap between kids from low-income homes and their more advantaged peers. The achievement gap has only grown over the last several decades, and which indicates that the remediation efforts that are underway are not bearing the kind of fruit that we would like them to bear, and we believe that the negative neurologic impact of poverty and adverse life events has not been appropriately understood, so that hardworking educators are trying to remediate away a problem they haven't adequately identified. Once you, what we have is an evidence-based intervention that enables high-poverty kids to achieve on par with their more advantaged peers.
That's Margaret Martin. We should mention again that she'll be discussing the Harmony Project and the Power of Music this evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. There's a reception at 6, and the presentation starts at 6:30. You can reserve a seat at kclibrary.org. We're going out with an outdoor concert by Harmony Project KC. They're playing with a brass quintet from the Symphony at the Kansas City Museum. The title of this piece is New World Symphony. Thank you, Dr. Margaret Martin.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to Andrew Loveland, a student at Los Angeles City College. He joined us by Skype. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, you know him from Breaking Bad and Malcolm in the Middle. Bryan Cranston is coming to town this week, too. We'll have a conversation with him, plus this week's local listen. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, Steve spoke with an up-and-coming opera tenor from Prairie Village and explored a different way also to think about victims of sexual violence. You can find both of those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Join us tomorrow. We'll hear local reactions to tonight's presidential debate. We'll also speak with a civil rights leader and eyewitness to the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. Well, his name is Bryan Cranston, but you may know him just as well from the men he's played on TV and in the movies, Lyndon Johnson, Hal, Dalton Trumbo, Dr. Tim Whatley, and, of course, Walter White of the late, great Breaking Bad. In the history of the Emmys, he's the first actor in a cable series and the second lead actor ever to win 3 consecutive awards. Bryan Cranston has summed up all his roles and honors in a new memoir, A Life in Parts. In advance of his appearance in town this Friday, he spoke with up-to-date host Steve Kraske.
Bryan Cranston, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you, Steve. Good to talk to you.
I've read that when it comes time for you to film tough scenes, and by tough I mean gruesome, that you often channel your own demons to get the job done. There's that one scene in Breaking Bad, for instance, where you come across Jesse and his girlfriend, and they've been doing drugs, and you watch Jane, the girlfriend, die right in front of your eyes. There's real torment on your face as you watch this. And I'm wondering, what were you thinking to get yourself into that place where you could be as tortured as you were in that moment, Bryan?
Well, it's interesting, Steve, because as an actor, you really do need to have an avenue to your emotions. And so you have to be willing and vulnerable to open up and show the darker sides of your personality, you know, jealousies and hate and anger and resentment and all those things, as well as the good sides. And in that case, when someone is about to die, what I was thinking in prep before of it, it was like, this girl is young enough to be my daughter. I should help her. She's just, you know, she's lost her way and all those things. And then you counteract that with, no, she's already threatened me, and that my whole enterprise could go under, and she's going to kill him. So you're going through all these emotions, but you don't want to set anything. You want to let the possibility of all those things or none of those things come to you. And that's why we do multiple takes, just to make sure that the experience that you're living is an honest one. And if it's feeling honest to you, then that will convey the same feeling to the audience. And so that's the hope of all actors, is to have a string of honest emotions and experiences that tell a story.
Hey, how many takes did you do of that particular scene? Do you recall?
I don't recall. Usually you do several takes from each angle when you're shooting a film or a television show. And so it takes a long time, and you have to then tap back into those emotions each and every time. It's exhausting. I can't tell you how tiring it is. It's, you know, and I say that fully aware that I'm the luckiest guy in the world, that I get to do this for a living. But there is an emotional cost to it. I go home and I sleep well because I'm just so worn out.
In that scene, Brian, you had tears coming down your cheeks, at least the take that I watched, everyone watched on TV. Did you do that every time?
Yeah.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a willingness, despite the exhaustion or the repetitive nature of it, is to go back in and do it again and do it again and do it again and do it again.
Wow. Just,
you have to have a mindset, and it's a craft, it's a skill connected to it. The longer that actors do that, the easier it is for them to tap into it. It's not easy, but it's just easier because we're more familiar with it. But that's not unlike any other job description. The more you do something over and over again, it becomes a familiar muscle to you. And whether it's a physical act or emotional or a mental act, it becomes almost by rote. You know it so well. It's almost like how we feel about driving a car now. We don't get into our car and go, okay, now I'm going to turn the key. Now I'm going to put this here. Now I'm going to look in the mirrors to see if there's a... We just do it because we've done it so many times.
But even conjuring up that level of torment, that level of angst is like driving a car for you?
Yeah, it is in a way.
Wow.
I don't mean to diminish it because it is an emotional experience, but because I do it so often that it's a place that I know I can unlock at any given time. When I put myself into a state of relaxation and concentration, then it comes.
You know, there's no question you've done such incredible work in Breaking Bad, and so many folks, you've been so widely acclaimed for that. But that role was so rich. Did you ever feel like if you blew that one, you had no business being an actor?
No, you don't go into it feeling like that. I guess it's like a fighter going into the ring. If he is thinking, oh man, I don't know if I'm going to win this. I don't think I can beat this guy. You're definitely going to lose. You just got to go in there feeling like you are going to win every fight. And every time you go to an audition or a job, you just have to have faith that that character is going to find a place within you, and you'll be fine. You just have to trust that that'll happen. And the more often you do it, and the more you work, there's no substitute for the time you put in and do the work, do the research, do the imagination work, too, that it'll come. Just have to believe it.
Hey, you got that role in Breaking Bad how, Brian?
Well, it's a story in the book, actually. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting way that it came about. First of all, about 1998, I did an episode of The X-Files, and I just happened to be available. I was only back in Los Angeles for 3 days when that audition came up. I could have easily have missed it because I was working out of town. But I got it, and that episode was written by Vince Gilligan. Little did I know that 8 years later, I would be meeting him again, and he would become my champion to get the role of Walter White. But there's so much luck involved, Steve. It really is. You have to be prepared. You have to work at your art form. But there's a lot of luck involved. At the time, Malcolm in the Middle was winding down its seventh season. And we were told by Fox that we could get picked up for another year. And we were keeping our fingers crossed. Wouldn't that be great? We had a great family. We loved it, laughing at work. We just had a great time. We're all hoping it would happen. In early May, we were told, no, we will not get the eighth season, so shut it down. And we were disappointed. But had we gotten that eighth season, it would have shot all the way through the next year in March or April. And someone else would have gotten the role of Walter White because I was not available, because I would have been shooting the eighth season of Malcolm in the Middle. So what appears to be a negative at any given time turned out to be a huge positive for me. So that's just the way I look at life. I don't think that anything that may appear like, oh, that's too bad, I don't know, who knows, it wasn't meant for me. I have a fatalistic attitude toward it and just go with the flow. I don't hold on to things. I was just nominated for an Emmy for the movie All the Way,
mm-hmm.
where I played President
Lyndon Johnson. Yeah,
I didn't win, and someone said, "Oh, are you bummed? Are you upset? Are you disappointed?" And I go, "No. I had a great opportunity to do it. That Emmy didn't belong to me. It now belongs to Courtney B. Vance, and rightfully so. He was terrific.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't already take ownership of it because it wasn't given to me. So I just stayed back from that. Like, wow, look, we're all invited to this party and we've done some great work around here and celebrating the art form, and whatever happens, happens. And it went to him, and it's like, okay, good. Good for you. And I meant that. I didn't, there wasn't any like, oh, that's terrible, or I hate this, or the desire to want it so much that it
right.
turns you sour on other people's victories.
I'm visiting with actor Bryan Cranston. He'll be speaking at 8 o'clock on October 21st at the Uptown Theater at an event co-sponsored by Rainy Day Books and The Middle of the Map, his new memoir, A Life in Parts. You were talking about luck just a minute ago, Bryan, and you say in the book that luck is key to any actor's career, integral to the whole enterprise. Do I have that right?
You do. It's not possible. I think it extends to anyone within the arts. I think, Steve, you look back on the breaks that you had at some point. Look at the
sure.
places that you were at the right place at the right time, and someone said, okay, kid, let's see what you got. And you have to be prepared for that opportunity, yes. But it takes a series of breaks for anyone in the arts to find success, because the arts will never have a lack of interest. There's never going to be a shortage of actors. It's a thing that, you know, in the music and art and painting and dance, and it's a very, very attracted avenue by many, many different people
yeah.
to go into that environment to compete. But mostly it's really you compete with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
When I finish an audition, I would assess it by myself and say, did I do everything I wanted to do in that room? Did I deliver the compelling character that I thought I had? And if I did, that's my victory. I celebrated that victory. And I didn't even think about anything beyond that, because it's not my decision.
Hmm.
I had to allow myself the pleasure and give myself credit for doing well, and allow it to happen when it's supposed to happen.
How soon did you know that Breaking Bad was going to work, that it was going to be something of a hit?
When I saw the first episode, the pilot episode, at a screening, I realized, wow, this all came together. I read it off the page, and off the page, it worked to me.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean it's going to all come together.
Mm-hmm.
Making a television show or a movie is like cooking a souffle, that you hope, you can have all the right ingredients, but if something goes wrong, the temperature or something turned in one of the ingredients and it doesn't rise, it's like, oh, it didn't work. And why? I don't know. We had all the right things. It just didn't rise. So when I saw the pilot episode and I realized, this is something special. We have something very special here. But still, there's no way that you would have heard me say, we're going to be a hit.
Mm-hmm.
No way. Because it takes even more luck. People have to find it. Critics have to like it.
But
people have to talk about it over the proverbial water cooler.
How worried were you that Walter White was going to typecast you in a way that you would never get away from him?
Well, I wasn't worried, but I was thoughtful of
mm-hmm.
it. And that's why about a year before the last season started, I put out feelers to my agency that I wanted to look for a play. I knew that the zeitgeist of Walter White and Breaking Bad became bigger than any of us had ever thought it was possible. And it was an avalanche of attention and thought, and it created, you know, there are people with my face on their butts in a tattoo. There is paintings under undercrossings in Spain, and there's people carve my face into their heads, in their hair, and it's bizarre what happened to that world. And I knew that it was way, way bigger than I ever thought possible, and I felt I need to get away from this avalanche. I need to get far away from it. So I need to get away from the medium. I need to not do series television for 3 years, and I gave myself that moratorium. This movie, Lyndon Johnson, with All the Way, I just recently did. It's the first time I'd been on television in 3 years. And so that was by design. But to go off and then do a play was my hope, so I can still do what I love to do and create characters and tell stories, but in a different medium, so that I wasn't traipsing on the ghost of Walter White.
Well, people raved about your portrayal of LBJ, and I was really struck by what Bill Moyers once said about the former president, Bill Moyers being LBJ's press secretary. He once told you, Bill Moyers did, that LBJ was 11 of the most interesting people he had ever known, all wrapped up into one person. So I was wondering, which role was tougher for you, LBJ or Walter White?
It's hard to put it in those terms. I think logistically, doing Lyndon Johnson was tougher because I had to prepare for a play, a three-hour play. And just the task of learning all those speeches and my character, Lyndon Johnson was on stage for all but 15 minutes of the three-hour play. So it was daunting, to say the least, and it was a cram session to be able to not only get the words in your head, but then attach them to meaning so that it had some resonance when you said them and it made sense to an audience. Plus, the logistics and details of where to stand, where to go, what to pick up, when to exit, where to exit, all those things, and then the relationship to Lady Bird and Humphrey and all the other characters in the play. It was a monumental thing for me to learn, and I had to learn it first in Boston the first time. And I had roughly 3 weeks. I used a month because the last week of rehearsal was for tech purposes only. So that wasn't really a rehearsal for me, but I was still cramming. So for 1 month, 7 days a week, I was just on book, just cramming. And that was very difficult. And I described that in the book, the difficulty of it, and the insecurity that seeped in at times, and the worry and fear that I wasn't going to get it. Having the classic actor's nightmare where you're on stage and nothing comes out. You forget what you're supposed to say.
Wow.
And that was happening to me a little by little, and I just had to push it aside and persevere. But it was risky. It was, and I felt the pressure of that. And I said, that's got to be one of the toughest jobs I've had.
So just a final thing, Brian, stardom. Is it all that it's cracked up to be?
Stardom. Wow. That's a big question.
Because you didn't have it for a long time. And then suddenly you did in ways you never could have dreamed. Yeah.
I'll tell you what, so Steve, I'm grateful for the tremendous opportunity that stardom has brought, working with top-line writers and directors and producers. And I'm also grateful that happened to me later in life. I think I'm 60 now, and I got Malcolm in the Middle when I was almost 40. So I was more mature and ready for it.
Yeah.
As if anybody can be ready for it. But it's kind of, the sensibility is kind of like you're living your life and you win the lottery. You know, you hear of those people who just all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they win the lottery and they are thrust in the public eye. They are thrust into an economic status that they are not familiar with. They obtain more friends and family members than they ever knew they had. And it's kind of like the massive amount of attention on you. And some people just say, go ahead, deal with it now. And it's not easy to deal with. It takes a lot of thought and maturity and patience and hope that you make the right decisions. There's lovely things about it, but you do lose your anonymity. You do lose your sense of, I'm just going to go to the store and buy something.
Right.
No, you can't do that because you're dealing with attention constantly. Constantly dealing with attention. And it is what it is for me now. It's not what I seek. I enjoy the process of acting and storytelling. And that's what I really, really feel a sense of empowerment from that, not from outward attention.
Bryan Cranston's memoir is just out. It's titled A Life in Parts. Critics are saying very nice things about it. He'll speak at 8 o'clock on October 21st at the Uptown Theater at an event co-sponsored by Rainy Day Books in Fairway and Middle of the Map. Bryan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. Best of
Thank
luck
you.
To you.
Hope to see you on the 21st.
You will, Bryan. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
That was KCUR's Steve Kraske speaking with actor Bryan Cranston. And now KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is in the studio with us. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
It's great to see you.
Thank you.
So you are here with our local listen, and we have a truly iconic rock band with us today.
We sure do. It's Kansas, and no band in my life has maybe inspired me more than Kansas.
No kidding.
The idea that ordinary-looking guys from the most ordinary place in the United States, Topeka, Kansas, could become the most popular rock band in the world made me think that anything is possible.
I have to say, there's a couple things that surprised me here. First of all, maybe I'm just unknowing of these things. I know I am, in fact, but I didn't really realize they were from Kansas. That wasn't just their name.
They are truly Topeka boys, and one of their most popular songs, Miracle Out of Nowhere, is, I think, referencing their humble origin.
I think the other thing I have to admit I'm surprised by is that they're still singing and making music.
Decades after their commercial prime in the 70s, they're still together, even though only two original members are still with the band.
But two of them still are, and that's 40-some years is a long time.
It's a very long time.
Well, the song you picked for today is from their latest album, which is called The Prelude Implicit. What are we going to hear here?
We're going to hear the first song on the album. It's called With This Heart. And even with the new vocalist, and even though it's their first album in 16 years, they recaptured that old Kansas sound.
All right. Well, let's take a listen to With This Heart by Kansas. All right, so that's With This Heart by Kansas. This is their first album in a while, you said. When did you say the last one was?
The last one was in the year 2000.
That's a long time to go. What has changed about them, do you think?
Well, nothing, and I think that's the point. the personnel has changed, but you know, every band, even if it's 16 years, needs to, you know, eventually put something out if they, you know, continue to ask people to buy tickets.
One of those changes seems to be the lead singer. That's a pretty major change for a band.
Yeah, their old front man was energetic and had a lot of personality, but most of all, he had this strong voice. And the guy we hear singing now, Richie Platt, sounds almost exactly the same.
Yeah.
Which I suppose is a good thing, and that's what fans want, especially when they're going to be singing the older material as well.
Right, which I'm sure is what fans want. Where will they be playing?
Kansas plays at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts on Saturday.
That's a very classy rock venue.
Yeah, it's, you know, they're going to be in the Muriel Kauffman Theater where the, opera's home, and it's also the home of the ballet. But, you know, Kansas has that symphonic element, and you can hear the violin right now. So, you know, it's not that unnatural that they're playing in that room.
Well, that's Kansas. They perform, as Bill said, on Saturday at the Muriel Kauffman Theater, the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. Bill Brownlee with our local listen. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Good to have you here. You can listen to this again or to any of our program today or our previous ones. You can also download our podcasts at kcur.org/up-to-date. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR up-to-date, and I'm at PTS Brian. Steve will be back tomorrow. We'll hear reactions from local undecided voters about the presidential debate that's going on tonight. Also, a firsthand account of the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. Programs produced by Danny Alexander. Senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.